This Janet Mefford Today podcast is sponsored by Heart for Lebanon, the Christian ministry working among 2 million Syrian refugee families who've been displaced. For just $29 a month, you can help Heart for Lebanon reach out in Jesus' name to a family of six, providing them with food, Christian education, survival essentials, and the gospel. Please call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499 or janetmefford.com.
This is Janet Mefford Today.
Our confidence is in Christ alone.
Are we going to stand with God, come what may?
If the Word of God says it, I believe it.
And that's the way it is.
And now, here is Janet Mefford.
Thank you so much for joining us again. While Pew Research Center's latest religious landscape study shows 83% of American adults hold to a strong belief in God, but how many of those people can articulate the reason for God's existence based upon objective truth? And how can reason and logic from common experiences of our daily reality help us to understand the truth and the reality about God? Well, today we're going to talk about it with Leo Severino. He has a background in film and philosophy, having previously worked at 20th Century Fox before co-founding Metanoia Films. And today we'll be talking about his book called Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth. And Leo, it's great to have you here. How are you?
I'm really well. Thank you for having me, Jenna. Thank you for all your good work.
Well, it's wonderful to have you here. I really enjoyed going through your book because this is a great approach. I think it's interesting, too, where you're coming from, because you say right at the outset, you used to think there was no such thing as truth. What changed your mind?
Well, by the way, thank you for saying kind things about the book. It means a lot coming from you that you would take the time and have me on the air. But what changed my mind was examining the concept, was really thinking it. I literally had a moment when I was speaking to someone, and they were saying, "No, there's no such thing as truth," and that was kind of a given, even in philosophical circles. And then it dawned me, and this is something that it's the way I start the book, and it's something that I would urge anybody: if someone tells you there is no truth, your immediate question should be, is that true?
Right.
Because really what you're saying is, it is true that there is no truth. And, you know, someone might come back and say, well, I don't mean there's no such thing as truth in any sense, right? It might be true that I like apples and you don't. What I mean is that there's no objective truth. There's no absolute truth to which you say, is that absolutely true?
Yes.
Is what you're saying, does it apply to everyone or just sometimes, right?
Sure.
And no matter how we slice it, it turns out it's a philosophical axiom. It's a rule of logic that if anything meets anything, there must be such a thing as truth, and it has to be objective and it has to be universal.
Right.
So that was a starting point that eventually led me to this massive rabbit hole that eventually got me to God himself.
Yeah. It's so interesting. Why make the case, do you think, when you're starting out making the argument that you make throughout the book, why is it the case that truth must exist, just from a logical standpoint?
Well, if truth doesn't, then we shouldn't speak. If someone truly believes that there is no such a thing as truth, they should never say anything. They should never do anything. Because at every moment, their behavior, their thoughts are speaking against them.
Yeah.
Right? The very fact that someone sits in a chair implies some truth. They believe that the chair is strong enough to hold their weight. We would see it in the opposite. If there was some reason they were hesitant to sit in a particular chair, we would think, oh, they must be gauging something about the reality that is contrary to what their thought is. The chair is not strong enough to hold their weight. There's spilled something on it, et cetera. So it's not really, it is a self-evident principle. It's something you have to deduce. What we have to try to deduce is the opposite. If people make a claim contrary to it, then you can show by logic that the claim is absurd. It would be like saying a mother saying that she gave birth to herself. It just doesn't make any sense.
Right. Yeah, that's right. Well, it's interesting, though, because it seems that our modern way of thinking doesn't involve logic a lot of times. If you hear skeptics or atheists speaking about, or relativists saying there's no such thing as truth, or some will say, you can have your truth, but I have my truth. What do you think is driving that? Is it just a desire to get away from any sort of moral authority? Do you think that's really what's behind it?
I'm sure it's part of it, but frankly, I don't know. In as much as, you know, my expertise isn't psychology, so I'm not sure what's happening internally. My hunch, however, is that people, particularly people of faith, we, I think, have this skepticism about logic and about truth. And there's kind of two extremes. There's people who don't have faith, who believe that matters of faith are just have nothing to do with logic and truth. And in a certain sense, people of faith thinking that faith is what you believe in the not only in the absence of evidence, but in spite of evidence. All evidence to the contrary, you know, I still have faith.
Yes.
Neither which of those is satisfying. We know that the entire tradition is that faith seeks understanding, that there is something in us that not only wants to know the truth, but wants to know it even to things that are just beyond our grasp, right?
Right.
And that's why I tried to put this book together. This book, I thought, was to try to meet people who believe whatever they believe, but have some inkling towards, maybe there's an explanation. Maybe there's some truth out there that I can grasp at a very digestible ease. This book is not meant for philosophers and theologians. This book is meant for the everyday person to try to shore up, gaps maybe in our knowledge about our faith or about just truth in general.
Yeah, so true. Talk about this cause and effect. You talk about this in the second chapter where you use this story about a leaf falling. Can you walk people through that? Because I think that was a really great point you were making.
Well, thank you for saying that. Well, I start with this notion that there has to be truth. And then I say, well, listen, being that we know that something has to be true, can we go further with other things that we know are true? And so I use the example of, let's just say you and I are sitting here and there's a tree and we see a leaf falling from the tree. Well, we know that that event was true. It happened. But contained within that, there's a bunch of other truths that we can know are necessarily true. We might not know why precisely the leaf fell. Maybe it was the change of the seasons, the maturation of the leaf. Maybe it was a nibbling squirrel. Maybe it was just a wind. We might not know that, but we know one thing for certain. That leaf was on the tree.
Yeah.
If the leaf wasn't on the tree, then the leaf wouldn't have fallen from the tree. And then I said, well, okay, if we can grasp that is absolutely true, well, then what else can we know? Well, if there were no branch, there'd be no leaf. If there were no trunk, there'd be no branch. There'd be no leaf. If there were no sapling, there'd be... And I start making massive jumps. At some point, if there was no earth, there would obviously be no trunk for there to be no branch, for there to be no leaf. And the question is, how far back can we go? And it turns out that exploring how far back we can go leads us to something insanely interesting, which is explained in two simple examples, if I might, Jen, if we have the time. Can I share a couple
go
of examples as to where this sort of thought process goes?
Yes.
Okay, so
go.
The first is this. At some point, our actual specific knowledge of what those things might have been that were required eventually for a leaf fall from the tree, like the existence of a solar system or a galaxy. At some point, our knowledge, is fuzzy about these things. Maybe astrophysicists know better than we do. But we know this for certain. Something had to have preceded something, had to have preceded something, had to preceded something, and eventually the leaf fell. My question is, how far back can we go? And it seems that we can keep going back to infinity. We can say that there was something previously, and then there had to be something before that and something before that. But there's a problem with that logic, and I use the two examples. Example number one is, if I ran to the radio studio from my house, and you asked me where my house was, and I said, it's real easy. It's infinity that way. There would obviously be some sort of short circuit in our top five. We'd be like, what doesn't make any sense? Because of the fact that I arrived, it implies that however far I ran, it couldn't have been infinitely far. The same way if I brought to your studio, Jenny, I said, here, this is some delicious brownies. I want you to try them. And you try them, you're like, well, they're actually really tasty. And it's my wife's recipe. And her ingredients list is very simple. It's an infinitely long list of ingredients. We would both say, well, again, there's something wrong with that picture. The very fact that you're eating the brownie implies that however long the list of the ingredients that are necessary to make the brownie, they couldn't be infinitely long because we would forever be collecting ingredients, never get to the baking, forget about the eating.
Sure.
Make sense?
Yes.
So far?
Yes.
Well, what does that have to do with the falling leaf? Everything. However much space and time, however much distance the leaf has traversed to get to where it got to fall, it couldn't be an infinitely long series of events. It's like running from my house. However many ingredients were necessary to bake the falling leaf, however many causes are in that causal chain that leads to the falling leaf, they couldn't be infinitely long. They would be forever collecting ingredients that are necessary for the leaf to fall and never get into the actual falling. So by pure logical deduction, we have to conclude that however long the list is of the causes that preceded the falling leaf, even if we don't know what they are, it couldn't be infinitely long.
Right.
Which means it's finite. And if it's finite, that means you can count them. And if you can count them, eventually you're going to get to a first. And if you can get to a first, that's where something crazy interesting happens, right?
Oh.
Which is part of a longer discussion, but eventually we're going to get to.
Yes.
Ultimately, from that to God.
Absolutely. You know what? This is a perfect time to take a break. We're going to do that with Leo Severino. His book is called Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth. Can't wait to get back to this discussion. We'll be right back on Janet Meffer Today. Hi, this is Janet Mefford. It may be hard for Americans to believe, but there are many people in Lebanon who have never heard anything about Jesus. That's exactly why Heart for Lebanon is there, working in the nation that's currently home to more than 2 million Syrian refugee families who have been displaced through no fault of their own. Every day, Heart for Lebanon is reaching out to these families in Jesus' name, telling them about Him, and providing food, Christian education, and survival essentials. And the Lord is changing lives. One little girl we'll call Shayna was one of those refugee kids who had never heard of Jesus until she entered Heart for Lebanon's educational program. When Shayna was given the assignment to write about a defining moment in her life, she chose to write this. We were in Syria and we knew nothing about Christ the Lord. When we came to Lebanon, I joined Heart for Lebanon school. It is there where I got to know that Jesus Christ is the Savior of the world and that He can save my sins and that whosoever worships Him will have eternal life. And you know what? Shayna learned who Jesus was because someone here in the United States supported the important work of Heart for Lebanon. And you can support them too. Right now, you can help rescue a child like Shayna and her family with food, Christian education, and survival essentials for just 98 cents a day. That's just $29 a month to rescue a family of six. Call now, 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. These families need immediate help. And more than that, they need Jesus Christ. And they need to hear the gospel that can save. Please help the important work of Heart for Lebanon today. Again, that number is 888-247-5499. That's 888-247-5499. Or there's a banner to click at janetmefford.com. Thank you so much for whatever you can do, and God bless you. Welcome back to Janet Meffer Today. We are going deeper, and that is the name of the book by Leo Severino, who's joining us. He is the co-founder of Metanoia Films, and this book, Going Deeper, A Reasoned Exploration of God and Truth, is a really great read. I think you're taking us through the logical consequences that get us back to understanding God does exist, and in fact, God has to exist. When you examine the whole picture according to reason and logic, this is just so good, Leo. You were sharing this great story, getting us back to the first cause of all things, and we talked about the leaf falling from the tree, and you have to see all these things preceded that leaf falling. So now, when you get to this conclusion that there has to be a first cause, this is where a lot of people get tripped up. Well, I don't believe in God, and I believe that we were just here by random process and all these sorts of things. When you get somebody to the logical point of taking on this truth that, yes, there has to be a first cause, where do you go from there and how do you defend the first cause?
Well, that's where it gets very interesting. I mean, the defense of the first cause is in the proof of anything happened. It couldn't be preceded by an infinite series of causes or else the event wouldn't happen. The fact that it happened means however long the series is, it has to be finite, which means in theory you can count it and eventually you're going to get to a first. Well, what's the big deal about this first cause? Well, in order for it to be the first cause, that must mean that there's no cause before it. Because if there were a cause before that, well, then what caused that? And there'd be another cause, and then what caused that? And another cause, and eventually you get back into this backward-looking infinity,
yes,
and you never get to the leaf actually falling.
True.
So if we get stuck with this notion that there has to be a first cause, that means there's no cause before it, which means that the first cause is uncaused. So is that obviously God? No, the answer is no, not at this point in the analysis. But what it does get us, and this is just this is logically certain as 2 plus 2 equals 4. What it gets us is there has to be something that exists whose existence is uncreated,
right,
whose existence is necessary for everything after it to exist, but it itself exists in an uncaused way. Now, what that looks like, what that feels like, we don't know. We live in a causal temporal world, right? Everything around us points to causes and effects. But there has to be something that precedes the entire physical universe, because the falling leaf is just one arbitrary example. We could have pointed to anything and gone through the same analysis. Could be an infinitely long list of causes before it. It had to be finite, which means there's a first. Well, if that's the case, this first cause is unlike everything in the universe.
Right.
And it's necessary in the causal chain of the universe for the universe to exist. So we have something that exists completely self-sufficiently, completely devoid of anything that could cause it, without any necessity. That's something that's radically interesting, because we're talking about something that's different than anything we can point to in the universe.
Right.
Now, from there, like I said, is that immediately God? No. But it turns out that if you keep going down that path, that logical path, you're going to get to all kinds of other things. You're going to get to the fact that there can only be one of these things. You're going to get to the fact that it's insanely powerful because it's necessary to account for the existence of everything in the universe. You're going to get to the fact that although it seems like it's something far in the past, it actually transcends both space and time and is necessary for any particle to exist in the here and the now. Now we're getting closer to something that we, our normal notion of who God is.
Yes.
And then eventually, this is near the end of the book, you're going to see how reasonable and how inductively certain it is that this thing not only thinks, but created without any necessity. In other words, it created for the good of the creation, which is the general definition of love. Now we're getting to somewhere closer to what we have as our notion of God.
That's great. That is so great. Well, now you also tackle the question of matter, and you walk people through matter existing in time and space, and matter is that which has parts. Why does matter matter, as it were? Why talk about matter in the context of proving the first cause and working your way to explaining that the first cause is, in fact, Almighty God?
Because one of the properties of the first cause is that it is immaterial, meaning it is not subject to the same causal spatial reality as everything that has parts, everything that is matter. And that's important, because from there, it's the gateway to getting to the omnipresence of God and the omniscience of God. In other words, it's part of the, if the first cause was simply a material thing in the universe, if it acted and behaved like matter does, then it couldn't by definition be the first cause. The fact that it's not material, the fact that it exists in an immaterial way, is something really mind-blowing. Because what we're doing is we're proving the fact that everything that we can touch and feel isn't the entire picture of what's going on in the universe. So that's a big one. It really opens up a lot of doors.
Yeah, it sure does. So now you get into questions of, all right, if there is a God, we'll just call him God, first cause, and this first cause is the reason that everything else exists, then you get into the question of where did matter come from? There are a lot of people who say matter was always there. How do you deal with that question of God creating ex nihilo, that he created everything out of nothing? Because that's a really mind-boggling thing for people to consider also.
And also, at some level, really, really, really simple. And that's what I'm trying to do with this book, is trying to share the way that I started grasping these truths in a way that I think is hopefully digestible. Well, let's try this one, right? In other words, what did God use to create the universe? What pre-existing matter was there that God could then take and mold and shape into the universe? Well, the question has a flaw in its presentation, in its formulation. If there is pre-existing matter, if matter has been around for forever, and we know that's impossible, because if it was around forever, it's been around for an infinity, which means we would never get to any particular point in time.
Yes.
Like the leaf falling from a tree.
Perfect.
So, but could there have been some pre-existing matter that then God then chose to use to make this universe? Well, the answer is no, and the reason is because if there was some pre-existing matter, where did that matter come from?
Right.
Was there a previous cause? Because we know matter, by its nature, lives in cause. Everything that we can point to that is material is an effect of something else.
Sure.
So this matter, where did that come from? Was there a previous first cause that then caused the matter that then this first cause used to make the universe? Well, if that's the case, then our first cause isn't really the first cause. Because in the chain of what was necessary to cause everything so that the leaf can fall, in that chain, it required something previous. Well, that means that the creation of the universe was already caused by something previous, and we said that the first cause was uncaused.
Yes.
So then what did the first cause use in order to make the universe? The answer has to be nothing.
Mm-hmm.
Because if it already existed, it was caused. And if it was already caused, it had to have been caused by this first cause. So there had to have been a point where there was no matter, where only the first cause existed, and then created everything from nothing. That's ex nihilo creation.
Absolutely. Well said. So now when you get to the issue of a first cause, now you can get into the aspects of God's character and whether or not the first cause is some sort of impersonal force versus the God that we read about in the Bible, and whether or not that first cause is thinking, what sort of being the first cause is. Now, how do you begin to deal with those issues from a logical standpoint?
Well, there's a whole bunch of ways, but I think the easiest, most clear path is one of what's called irreducible complexity, and I deal with this in a chapter of the book. It's really, really complicated, long title for a very, very, very simple concept, and the concept is this. Let's take a very, very ordinary item. Let's take a mousetrap, for example. Mousetrap really has five constituent parts. It has a piece of wood, a plank. It has a spring. It has a hammer that you pull back like a lever. It has a latch that holds the hammer in place, and it has some sort of device where you put the bait. Right? It's five parts. But if one of those parts is not there, the thing cannot work as a mousetrap. Right? If you don't have a spring to pull back, then it's not going to slam on the mouse. If you don't have the board, you have nothing to hold it together. If you don't have the hammer, there's nothing that... Get my point?
Yeah.
These five parts, all of them are necessary in order for this thing to work as a mousetrap. Because of that, when we see a mousetrap, we instantly conclude this was created for a purpose. This was not a random accident. Because of the complexity that is irreducible, what I mean by that is without any one of its parts, the thing can't work as a whole. That tells us something about the creation. It's for a purpose and it was designed.
Right.
No one would believe for a second that a mousetrap happened to have, that the origins of the first mousetrap was like this. A piece of wood happened to fall in somebody's garage onto the floor, and then over time, some sort of wood glue landed on it right in the appropriate place where a spring happened to land, that then attached a hammer, a lever, attached itself to it, that was then pulled back and all held together in this immaculate way, precisely when a mouse happened to walk by.
Right.
My point is, no one everything in the evidence would say that is improbable, but highly improbable to the point of impossibility. Well, something that is far more irreducibly complex than a mousetrap is the human eyeball. The human eyeball has something like somewhere between 1,000 to 10,000 irreducibly complex parts. Mm. If we didn't have the rods and cones precisely spaced, if we didn't have the density of the aqueous humor inside our eye, if our lens wasn't curved the exact same way, we would not be able to see. And so there's one of two possibilities. One, either this thing was designed or, like the mousetrap falling in the garage, over time, this thing kind of just happened randomly over given a bunch of different mutations, right? It seems like the one is far more probable than the other, that this was actually designed. In the same way, if we were to take a telescope and we looked into the sky and we saw it a distant planet, these shifting ships and patterns of sand that eventually started forming into building blocks that started building into this intricate pattern, and then it started firing lights across the different patterns of these building blocks, and we were able to deduce that it was some sort of language, and we can actually read it and decode it, we would think, oh my goodness, there's life on another planet. Well, take your eye, Janet, from that telescope and look into a microscope. And you're going to see the exact same thing. You're going to see little building blocks that are forming onto themselves in intricate patterns that light up in certain ways that form a code that is actually readable, that we can actually understand.
Yes.
Well, what you're looking at is DNA. On a different planet from a telescope, we would conclude there has to be intelligence behind it. But we look at a microscope and we see the exact same evidence and we conclude, it's random.
Isn't that crazy? I know. It's so crazy. I wish we had more time, but you got to get the book Going Deeper, Leo Severino with us. Leo, it was delightful to have you. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you, Jenny. Thank you for all your good work. And I do enjoy your show. I appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, Leo. God bless you. And we'll be right back on Janet Mefford Today. On Janet Mefford Today, the American Culture and Faith Institute recently released a survey And it showed that a shockingly small number of Bible-believing Christians feel a personal responsibility to share the gospel with non-believers. I know, it's really crazy because the Lord has clearly commanded us in His Word to evangelize the world and to make disciples of all nations. What is going on? Well, maybe part of the problem is Christians today simply don't know how to reach a millennial generation that is very highly digital in nature and often alienated from the church. But my next guest has some ideas for keeping the gospel fresh in a culture like ours. Daniel Rice is founder of Hashtag Gospel, an organization created to bring the gospel to the current generation in a way that syncs with their culture and uniqueness, and is out with a book, which is called Hashtag Gospel, Life, Hope, and Truth for Generation Now. Daniel, great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for so much for having me on, Janet.
Yeah, now you say something, Daniel, which is interesting to me. You say we only have 5 to 10 seconds to persuade somebody that what we're about to say is worth their time. That's not much time to make an impression. What are you talking about there? Why does that time pattern matter, especially in the context of spreading the gospel?
Well, we live in an increasingly information overloaded world, and even on your way to work this morning or as you go through your day, you are constantly bombarded with information. And all of us, you know, over the last few years have kind of built up this filter, a protective barrier to keep our brains from being overwhelmed with information. And so, you know, if a commercial comes on the television, you can pretty much guess within the first 5 or 10 seconds whether that commercial applies to you and whether you're going to listen to it. And the same goes for conversation. The same goes for any type of media that we come across during the day. It is simply a defensive mechanism. And if we are going to communicate the gospel in an effective way in today's age, we need to learn to do it in a way that bypasses that filter.
Now, that's an interesting thing. There have been many discussions over the years, as you know, about the best way to do the gospel. Do you present the Romans Road? Do you use the four spiritual laws? All of these different tactics have been used over the years. Do you think that fundamentally the way we evangelize, especially to the millennial generation and maybe younger than that, needs to change? In other words, have the past ways in which we've shared the gospel, do you see those as not being as effective with this generation?
Well, I think, first of all, the gospel remains the same as it was 2,000 years ago. But even Paul, when he went to different places, when he went to Athens, the first place that he kind of shared the gospel was in this high council area. And he said to the people listening, hey, guys, check out this statue that is here that says to the unknown God, I know him. Let me tell you about him. And then he proceeded to tell them all about this Jesus Christ and the gospel. And he used even some verbiage and some quotes from local poets in his presentation of the gospel. And you watch him go around from different city to different city. You never see him present the gospel the same way twice. He would always kind of get to know his audience and present it in a way that was engaging for them. And you mentioned some great methods of sharing the gospel, but I think each generation, and even in the generations, each culture kind of has their way that they're going to understand the gospel best, based on the way they interact with the world around them.
Very interesting. You're right. Of course, there are a lot of different ways that we can evangelize, and it does change. The message doesn't change, but sometimes some of the techniques change based on who you're speaking to. You're concerned, I know, about people, especially on the fringes of the church. So when you're talking about doing evangelism in a way that works for these people, what sorts of ideas do you have along those lines for people who really might have grown up in church, but they've left? How do you reach those people? What sorts of ideas do you have?
Well, I think probably, and this is kind of a universal truth, one of the best ways to share the gospel is to listen first. And people are on the fringes for a reason. They just didn't pick, you know, I am going to be on the fringe today. You know, the things that have happened to them in their life and, you know, the ways that they have interacted with the world around them have put them where they are. And so we, you know, it's kind of our job is, if we want to share the gospel effectively, is to learn about them, find out about them, care about them. If the two greatest commandments are love God and love others, you know, caring about people to learn enough to learn their story should be kind of a no-brainer. And so, you know, as we look at these groups that either have grown up in the church and been burned or became disillusioned or disenfranchised, first thing we need to do, instead of, you know, trying to look to a, maybe a formulaic approach, is to learn about them and get to know them and find out why they are where they are.
Right. So then when we go back to the 5 to 10 seconds scenario that we discussed before, how do you use that first 5 to 10 seconds with somebody like that to even get that conversation going?
Well, a lot of times people will elongate that window of opportunity if they sense that you care about them and if you're genuinely interested in what they have to say. So that is probably the number one thing. The number two thing is, once you find out what they're interested in, have a conversation about it. We at Hashtag Gospel do that through a number of ways, social media being one. What a great opportunity to share the gospel in a worldwide global marketplace. I mean, that's one of the places that Paul used to love to go, is to the marketplace and strike up conversations. And social media is a powerful tool for good or evil. And, you know, what a great place to go and to strike up conversations with anybody who will listen about the best news that's ever been told on earth.
Right. Now, when you raise the issue of social media, you're right, it can be used as a tool for good or evil, depending on the people you're interacting with, for sure. But the problem, for example, with some social media is the limitations you might have, whether it's the number of words you can use, or if it's a media that really has pictures more than it has words. What do you find is some of the challenges of using social media in order to spread the gospel? And what would you say are some of the advantages of using social media?
Yeah, I would say social media is like any other tool. If you use it for the purpose it was intended for, or what it excels at, it's going to work well. You know, if you use it for something that it never was intended for or doesn't work well at, it's going to fail. If you try to use a hammer to screw in a screw, you know, that's not going to be great. And so, you know, with social media, it is kind of a mass market on-ramp to discussions about the gospel. And so what we have done is we've created some social media content that really kind of opens the door for conversation. I think a lot of people would agree that, you know, when you're sharing with the gospel, when you're sharing the gospel with someone, it's rarely ever the first time they've ever heard it. And yeah, as God is drawing someone to himself, it's usually he's working a bunch of different angles. And there are many different people and many different environments and things that he's using to draw them. And so what social media can be, or what we've also have a short little video series that talks about some of these things, or what the book or, you know, personal relationships can be, is kind of one step in that chain to draw them to a place where they can choose what they want to do with the gospel.
Yeah. So would videos be one of your prime tools on social media for drawing people in? I watched one of your videos, for example, on your website about a rescue plan, which was very well done. Is that your primary way of getting people drawn in a little bit to further the conversation?
Sure. Yeah, that is one way that we do it. And if you'll notice, all the videos are 2 minutes or less.
Yes,
because we live
right
in such a busy time, and if you're scrolling through social media and a video comes up, it could be a great video about making meatloaf, but if it's a 20-minute video and you've got 1 minute, I'm sorry.
Moving on.
It's going to go, yep, scrolling past. And so, you know, what these videos do is they're made to be compelling communicators of little parts of the gospel in and of themselves, but short enough so that people don't scroll past. Or, you know, I've even used them in conversation when we're talking about a specific topic. You know, just pull out my phone and go to Facebook and click on one of the videos on, let's say, forgiveness. You know, God can't forgive me. I've done too many bad things. Well, let me show you this little video here, and it's only 2 minutes long, and they do a great job of really in a succinct way communicating biblical truth.
Very good. Well, we're going to go to a break. We'll come right back with Daniel Rice. Hashtag Gospel is his book, and we'll be back after this on Janet Meffer Today. Stay with us.
Are
Are you among the millions of Americans who feel uncertain when it comes to your health care? As a Christian, are you looking for health care that doesn't violate your morals and convictions? Well, we're happy to inform you that there is a solution, and that solution is Liberty HealthShare. Liberty HealthShare is a community of like-minded Christians who work together to pay for their medical costs. It allows you to decide how, when, and where you will access health care so you can make the best choice for you and your family. Starting at $249 for a single, up to $529 a month for a family. That's mom, dad, and all the kids. This is how healthcare should be. For more information, call 855-585-4237 or visit lightyourliberty.com. That's lightyourliberty.com and regain control over your healthcare costs. 855-585-4237 or lightyourliberty.com. Together, we're changing healthcare for good.
Hi, this is Mike Reagan, author, political commentator, and son of the 40th President of the United States, Ronald Reagan. And I enthusiastically support the life-saving work of Preborn. They work 24/7 in the highest abortion cities in America to care for moms in unplanned pregnancies. Would you go to preborn.org today and help save an innocent baby's life?
Saving a baby's life has never been as important as it is right now. With more and more states legalizing abortion up to 9 months, the Ministry of Preborn is the largest provider of free ultrasound sessions in the nation. Would you join with Preborn and Janet Mefford today to help save babies? For $140, you can sponsor 5 ultrasounds and help save 5 babies from abortion. All gifts are tax deductible, and when you donate, you'll receive a story and a picture of 5 babies whose lives were spared. To donate, call 855-402-BABY, 855-402-2229. That's 855-402-BABY, or there's a banner to click at JanetMefford.com. We are back on Janet Mefford today talking about ways to engage people, especially in the millennial generation and maybe even younger, and move these folks in the direction of conversations where they will be able to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. There are a lot of people on the margins these days. We see these statistics all the time about millennials who maybe had grown up in the church and then left the church. They're kind of on the fringes. And this is a digital age. There are different cultural things that they are drawn to that perhaps boomers or busters might not have been drawn to, but we've got to take into consideration how this generation thinks and acts. And so we are talking with Daniel Rice about this whole subject. His book is called Hashtag Gospel. So before we went to the break, Daniel, we were talking about some of the things that you do, especially online. You have video clips or video series sometimes that you will use to get conversation started. What I'm wondering is, where does it go from there? Because for a lot of people who do the older kind of evangelism, not that you're discounting that, but who are used to doing longer gospel presentations, the question might be, okay, well, we'll show a video, but how do you really get to the meat of the gospel of Jesus Christ, get into some of the scripture, explain it in a deep way that is going to take more time? Do they end up having the patience to sit through a conversation where you really do explain the biblical content of the gospel?
Yeah, that is a great question. And I think, you know, all these things that we're talking about, the videos, the website, the book, they're all just tools. And they're meant to be used by people who are interested in sharing the gospel and making disciples and building a relationship with the people that they're ministering to. And so outside of that relationship, you know, they're just kind of cold and dead. But in the context of relationship, they're pretty effective tools. And you bring up a good question just about, you know, this is kind of a longer process. You're exactly right. You know, sometimes, you know, these tools will give you an opportunity then to go deeper and talk about specific, you know, reasons that they have been reticent or holding back on Christ, or their reasons that they kind of have avoided church and avoided Christianity. And as we, you know, work through these things, you know, the Bible is everything we need for life and godliness. And so, you know, we can use the things that they are talking about to connect with parts of the Bible that really speak into the deep issues that they're feeling.
How effective have you found some of these approaches to be as you have been doing your own interacting with people online, for example?
Yeah, it's been a kind of a a new thing for me, but it's really been great to see people, you know, respond even locally. You know, I've been able to actually go through the book with a couple of people that have really enjoyed it, and people who aren't, you know, one of the guys that I was able to go through this book with, kind of we meet for lunch and talk. We just kind of slowly made our way through and, you know, talked about these issues, and so much of it was kind of brand new for him. And that is an incredible thing in what would seem to most of us a gospel-saturated society, to come across somebody who is unfamiliar with it. But I feel like that is more and more becoming the case. People are raised or have walked away and have put it out of their mind. And so when we talk about the gospel, when we talk about God's love, when we talk about by grace through faith, it is kind of a new concept.
Yeah, for a lot of people it is. Do you find among the people you're speaking about that there are one or two main points they're wrestling with? It seems in various generations there may be overwhelming issues of the time that might be what somebody would consider a barrier to my becoming a Christian. What sorts of things, if any, have come up in regard to the millennial generation that these issues are tough ones, but Christians do have answers to those?
Yeah, I think there are a few, and again, it depends on the person. That's why it's so important to talk to them and get to know them. But some things that rise to the surface that have been a barrier to the gospel is kind of the bad reputation that Christians have for being hateful and judgmental. Whether that's deserved or not, I think depends on the circumstance. But, right. You know, when you get to know somebody and they grow to trust you enough to kind of open up and talk about some of these things, I think that is just an enormous truth that helps them see that we, you know, the gospel is not about, you know, hatefulness. The gospel is not about, you know, judging people. It is about justice. It is about, you know, sin. It is about, you know, God's wrath. But it's also about a God who has loved his creation enough to make a way, you know, sparing no expense, not even the death of his own son.
Right. That's exactly right. So in your book, you're talking about Paul's explanation of the gospel in Romans. And Romans is one of my favorite books in the Bible. I'm sure it is yours as well. Everybody yeah. loves Romans. How do you take Romans and do Romans and explain the gospel as we see it in Romans on the internet or in a personal discussion with the millennial? How in the world do you incorporate the truths of Romans in a way that really grabs people as authentic and relevant?
Well, when you look at Jesus and the way that he would communicate truth to the people in his day, so many times he would pair it with a story. And that is in this book, hashtag gospel, what we have done. We've taken kind of the story, the concepts and truths in Romans from the first chapter all the way to the end, and paired each of these concepts with kind of a narrative or a story that really breaks it down. I mean, we open the book with Romans chapter 1, and we talk about coffee, of all things. You know, coffee is a universal thing accepted in almost, has some kind of form in almost every culture in the world, and yet, you know, we use this illustration about coffee to really dig into the concept of universal sin. And, you know, nobody wants to talk about necessarily universal sin, but they don't mind talking about coffee. And then even as we dig deeper into that illustration, we talk about, you know, fairness. And one of the things about Romans chapter 1 that's super encouraging for everybody is it's an even playing field. You know, it doesn't matter what color your skin is. It doesn't matter how many Facebook likes you have. It doesn't matter how much money you have. None of those things matter. We all start off on the same level, which is completely, you know, without hope. And it is only God that can give us that hope. And so, you know, those things are woven into the gospel. And our culture right now is really into equality. Our culture is really into making sure there's an even playing field, and using those cultural touch points, we can move into talking about the truth of the gospel.
Yeah. Now, for listeners who have been hearing your ideas and all the good ideas that you have using tools, social media tools and whatnot, in order to get conversations about the gospel started, they might be saying, well, what do I do? I don't make videos. I don't know how to do much on social media, but I would like to be able to do more evangelism of the younger generation. Maybe they're a Generation X or a boomer or buster, what have you, and they want to be able to evangelize to a younger generation, but feel a little bit insecure about their own social media skills. What sort of advice would you have for those listeners?
I think, again, it all comes back to the first thing you want to do if you want to reach somebody is love them, listen to them, try to understand where they're coming from. You know, and through building that relationship, doors will open. If you want to get to know, you know, the effective ways to reach millennials, you can, you know, there are a lot of great resources out there. You can log on to www.#gospel.com. We have different resources on there to use. But I think it really kind of goes back to, you know, you may not be media savvy, you may not be social media savvy, but you can listen and you can love. And if you do those two things well, that will open doors that you wouldn't even believe for sharing the gospel. And then it's not just about, you know, the sharing the gospel and trying to get someone to make a one-time decision. We're called to make disciples. So right. That means that the relationship continues after they would make a decision, and we then help them learn what it means to walk in the way that Christ would have us to walk. And, you know, really the hashtag gospel book talks about that quite a bit too. It doesn't stop with, you know, Romans chapter 7 and Romans chapter 8 and conversion. It goes on to what is now our role in society, what's our role in the rescue plan that God has, you know, drawn out from the beginning of time. And then at Romans in the later chapters, it talks about how we as Christians are to interact in a world that doesn't share our values, in a world that sometimes is even hostile to the way that we think. You know, how are we to interact there? And the Romans and the author Paul does a great job of really tackling some of those tough issues.
Absolutely. Well, such good advice and some really good ideas for how to start that conversation with people, whether it's online or in person. And you're right, you have to love people and care about them. And ultimately, that is key to fulfilling the Great Commission. The name of the book, again, hashtag gospel. And that is also the name of the website by Daniel Rice, #gospel.com. And Daniel, it was great to have you here. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Janet.
God bless you, and thank you for being part of our show today. And we thank you so much for tuning in. God bless you, and we'll see you next time.